press services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
Well, welcome to Training and Tactics Talk. I'm your host, Douglas Klein. And today we're going to start combining engine company and truck company operations as we began looking at the focus of fire scenes and putting tactical deployments into play. We definitely want to make sure that we're putting the right information out on the streets and giving you good abilities to train and take some of this knowledge into your companies and realize the importance of coordinating efforts on a fire scene, especially as we began doing truck work and engine work. Last time we talked about engine company operations and placements and how important it is and how the fire is going to go with that first line on the ground. Today we're gathered together in a group in a forum, which is a little different sometimes than we normally are, but I've got some great folks with me. Actually, I've brought on some people from High Point, North Carolina, my home department, where I work in the training division as a training commander. My boss is with me currently, which is the Deputy Chief of Administration, which is Barry Tilley. Barry brings in 30 years of experience. He's got 26 in High Point and has worked through the ranks. He actually spent some time in training as well. Also with me is a captain over in Station 3's district. Part of the research and development crew is Rick Manis. He's a captain on engine company number 3. And Rick brings a lot to the table. He's bringing 28 years in. He's looking forward to retirement and being busy and all the stuff he does. I know Rick does a lot of training with his folks, especially in engine company operations and how to make things better. And I got a good old friend with me, Jeff Pendelski, a battalion chief in Downers Grove, Illinois, is bringing in just a little over 20 years of experience. And just to remind you, Jeff is the author of the RICO textbook, the Rapid Intervention Company Operations book. So, guys, welcome aboard, and I look forward to what's going to be a power-packed session for today's program, talking engine trucks. We're going to throw a little rescue operations in. And, Chief, I want to throw it over to you. Give us a little thought process of how important you believe it is from a command level as to the integration of multiple company operations on fire scenes.
Well, the integration, everything needs to be a coordinated effort. We all know that. Today's challenge is making sure that all of our departments, regardless of the size, scope, paid, volunteer, whatever, that we have some continuity for our truck companies, what their functions are when they come in, what the engine companies do when they come in, so that you can have that same coordinated effort. A lot of times we see various groups, they have their own way of doing things. Some have no singular way of doing things at all, and others, they have it that crosses shifts. You can interchange folks from one shift to another shift, and if the tactics and the strategies that are employed are uniform across your department, it makes it a lot easier for an incident commander to deploy resources and make the appropriate moves on the fire ground to keep everybody safe.
I couldn't agree more. Definitely a coordinated effort, especially from a command and control perspective. And part of what I believe that we truly need to be doing is focusing in on running a fire scenes and operations on a fire scene being just like what Lou Holtz did on a football field. Now, I'm going to get the battle going here, guys. I know Jeff is an old truckie guy. I know Rick's an engine company guy. I've kind of worked amongst all the companies as far as being engine, being truck, and being on a rescue. And from a command perspective, being a battalion chief in a former life and being a fire chief. So I'm going to break the battle out here, guys. Which is better, engine or truck? Which is it going to be?
All right, I'll let you answer that first, Jeff.
Well, obviously, you know, the old adage that you always hear around is that the truck guys always refer to the engine guys as the speed bumps in the hallway for them. But quite honestly, Doug, we do have to realize that we have to work together because we are working for the same goal on the fire ground. And without either company attaining their goals, it can be a disaster for us as firefighters. It can lead up to situations where we can get ourselves seriously hurt, if not even killed, on the fire ground. So I think for the most part, the battles, they're good for the kitchen table, but that's something that we have to get past, and we have to really realize that we are in this together, and the engine feeds off of us, and we feed off the engine's operations that they put into place, too. So we have to work hand in hand.
All right, Rick, over to you. Captain on that engine company, give me your thoughts here of how important engine work is.
Well, I agree with Jeff right there that we're both have the same function and hope the outcome is going to be the same. And I've been on a truck before and mostly on an engine most of my career. But, yeah, we do joke around the kitchen table about it. But when we're all out on the fire ground, we're one team. And I need them for ventilation and rescue, and just like they need us for water and hose lines on the ground. And the outcome is always going to be the same.
Well, that's an important part. And for our listeners that are maybe in the volunteer ranks in rural America, you know, we don't discard the fact that there is truck work that goes on the scene, whether you have a nice, you know, tiller ladder pull-up or a big ladder company. There's still truck work that's got to be done. And I know that we've talked about this a lot in some of our other classes and things that we've done, Jeff, of doing truck work. Let's look at some integration here. As we begin getting onto the fire scenes, part of what we got to do is focus in on what tasks are important. We know that engine companies need to get in and probably need to get in more or less first and to put some hose lines on the ground and get the water supply. I know there's been a controversy here, Rick, in talking about dropping your own supply line going in on various different types of fires. Some folks believe that, you know, the second due company, because a lot of times they're close of getting the hydrant for the first due, letting them focus, you know, on fire attack and getting some operations in play. Let's talk a little bit about how we do it in High Point.
Well, I think it goes back to you need to know your area. You need to keep up with the companies that are in service closest to you. And as the bell goes off and you're being dispatched, I think you need to realize, okay, how close am I am to another company coming in, direction of travel, and hydrant locations. And then once you arrive on the scene, then you can evaluate what's showing. If there's a rescue, it's obvious, yeah, you got to deal with that first more than maybe laying your supply line. Because I've always said in the fire service, two things are our enemies, time and distance. And so time is going to be irrelevant right there in that scenario. But, you know, if you're far into your district and you got fire really short and you got companies either out of service close to you or they got a long way of travel, you might want to think about bringing your own water supply. So I think as a company officer, you really got to think about that on every scenario that you're dealt with.
All right, Chief, this is an important thing to you. I know that we've discussed this several times just in between you and I, and I know it's a paramount piece in the fire service when we look at the NOS reports and all the cases that come out with line-of-duty deaths or issues in post-incident analysis on fire scenes is communications. And Rick hit on that, you know, time and distance, and Jeff alluded to this of making things happen simultaneously. How important is communications to us on that fire scenes, and how well do you think the fire service in general is doing?
Well, communications is vital in anything you do. No matter what situation you're in, if you don't have effective communications, it's not going to go as well as it would if you have that effective communications back and forth. And it's not all about the use of the technology, the radios, whether you're using a VHF, UHF, 800 megahertz system, those type things. It's having common terminology, having standard operating procedures, guidelines that your department, area departments follow, so that when orders or instructions are given, that they're understood by all, including those who may not be involved in that particular operation, but they may have an associate type of function that they're performing. But communications is vital. Now, when you get into interior operations where you're in SCBA, the technology is still evolving. The clear, concise communications that firefighters can communicate back out to the incident commander and to other companies on the scene, I think is crucial. You know, a lot of times we get, you know, a lot of feedback from radios. We get garbled or scrambled information through our microphones that we have. But the future challenge will be to have a clear, integrated communications piece to our face piece. so that when we speak, it's much like we are here in this room, that we have that clear communication. I don't have to ask you to repeat because I had all this audio distortion or background noise, the environment noise that's going on with nozzles and trucks and bells going off and things like that. So it's vital that the communication piece take into consideration standard terminology, as well as taking advantage of the technology that's available to us today to make that communication legible at the other end.
Okay, let's get back to taking that communications component and putting it into the engine work and the truck work here. We know that engine companies, you know, part of their focus is getting hose lines into play. We know the sooner that we stop fire propagation or the growth of the fire through whatever tactic we use, the better off we are. So part of what we do on that is engine companies are stretching hose lines, and truck companies typically are looking at ventilation components. Now, in coordinating this together, how important is that? I'm going to throw it back to you, Rick. You're the engine guy. Your crew's making entry inside this structure. And let's make it a 2,800 square foot house. And it's a ranch-style house. It's got a pretty good-sized attic area in it with the pitch on the roof. And you're making entry, and you're under some fairly heavy smoke conditions as you start to go in. We're not at that pre-flashover level, but we're quickly approaching that. What's some of your thoughts about entering and how important it is for Jeff, our truck guy here, to get that place opened up and ventilated?
Well, I'd like to back up a little bit before I went into the house. With my size up, I need to think about if I need him to ventilate, I need to think about where I'm going to place my truck. That if I put it right there where he can't maybe use his aerial, if that house is way off the road, or if he's got to bring those ground ladders up, going back to what I said earlier, time and distance. So, you know, placement of that, my apparatus is going to be crucial for his apparatus. So now, once we've got that and we do make that interior attack, I can help him in locating where I need to hole cut if we do a vertical ventilation or if we've done a horizontal and everything. So, yeah, I think me coordinating with him and opening a hole or a window or whatever is very crucial for me and making advance into that area. So,
all right, Jeff, let's talk a little bit about ventilation here. You know, Captain Manus is definitely focused in on getting down the communications working here. You know, tactic-wise, we got a lot of choices on how we ventilate. We can go with a vertical ventilation going to the roof. A lot of factors to consider into that today, especially with lightweight truss construction, the time of burning, you know, on the fire growth tables. But also, the types of materials we're throwing in there is critical. We look at the thinking process of whether or not we open the roof, we do a window, we do positive pressure. Let's talk a little bit about those tactics there that are going on pretty much simultaneously to fire attack.
Okay. Well, Doug, again, as far as what tactics we're going to use for ventilation is also going to depend on our staffing in relation to the type of building that we are dealing with. Obviously, on a commercial building, you're gonna need a bigger crew up there to take care of the ventilation issue that you do have. And it's also vital that we do communicate off that roof what we see once we get up there to that engine company that's working inside. From that point above the fire building, we have a good vantage point that company officer on that engine company may not have really had before he did make entry. We got a view of all four sides now. We give him a good read on what we see from up there as far as fire location and conditions that he may not have been able to see also prior to that entry. Again, also, building construction type is going to have a big effect on what tools we possibly take up with us. Some departments on the truck companies, they like to utilize chainsaws versus circular type saws. Again, that's going to make a difference on which tool we actually choose to bring with us. What size hooks are we going to need to effectively reach through to make that ventilation hole in the interior materials. again, also, you referred to the problems that we're having today with today's construction. With lightweight truss construction, we have to be very cognizant of the buildings in our districts that do have that. We have to do the best job that we can to get out as a company, undress those buildings, know where those buildings are at so that we don't make the bad decision to go up on those roofs when we really shouldn't. Again, you know, looking at everything that's out there with the lightweight truss and pre-engineered construction that we have now, those trusses under fire conditions, they're coming down in less time than what it takes to really put them together on the assembly lines when they come from the factory. I mean, we're looking, you know, 4 to 6 minutes in some cases. You know, flashover conditions, now we're down to around 2 to 3.5 minutes in some cases, all depending on what's burning inside the building. And we have to really be asking ourselves, what effect is that going to be having on those structural components? So that is going to weigh heavily on if we do commit the crews to the roof, or if we're going to be doing ventilation from the ground level itself.
You brought out probably a key point here that sticks in my mind the most is personnel. And we all know that we've got a personnel issue as far as the amount of people we have. And everybody's trying to address this. And in the economic times that we're facing, it's even worse. And I'm going to jump over and talk about this from a different perspective. You and Rick both sitting in a municipal department, just as what I work in. I want to move to my other life and environment is being, you know, critical in an officer as far as administration and taking care of some things, but really focusing and functioning on a fire ground in a rural fire department in Ruffin, North Carolina, is, you know, personnel is really critical here. And, you know, Chief Tilley, I know that you came from a volunteer background, and we see it even in the career that we don't have enough people to get a lot of our tasks done, and it fits into that. So personnel is a key, and if you're trying to get a lot of things accomplished, like an interior attack, we're trying to put a initial rapid intervention company into play, and we're trying to get ventilation accomplished. A lot of people have opted out for this thought process, and I'm not against positive pressure ventilation by no means. In fact, I'm a proponent of using positive pressure ventilation because it is a tool. I believe in utilizing all the tools we have, but a lot of people have just jumped right in there, and that's the end-all, cure-all to things. And I saw a video. I shared that with Chief Tilley as we were working on some actual technology pieces the other day, where you get this quick flashover because inappropriate tactics were deployed. And this positive pressure fan, you know, in this video was put in, and people made entry. And, of course, you know, there were hose lines flowing on the rear of the structure, even though it was vented. There was heavy, heavy smoke, which was pre-flashover conditions, and that's exactly what occurred. We created a flashover. So how important to you guys is it, the ability to read smoke? And I'm going to start with you first, Chief. And in reading that smoke, what tactics go into play, and what do you think we can do, first of all, to train our people to have a better understanding of all these components that tie together, you know, the ties that bind, if you would?
Well, I think it's important reading of the smoke. Smoke can give us the indications of, first off, where our fire may be, especially in older construction. Newer construction houses today, residential structures are built so tightly that sometimes it's hard to read the smoke because it spreads throughout the interior, and it can't really seep out the house the way the older construction used to do without all the insulation and plastic and those type of things. So it's very difficult today. But under smoke conditions, the heavier they are, the more vital it is to have the appropriate ventilation in play. You spoke of the flashover speeding up. We have to create an avenue for the heated gases to leave the structure. We've got to get them out. So if you're using natural type of ventilation, you've got to make enough ventilation to get those superheated gases out. If you are going to use PPV, if you're putting 20,000 cubic feet a minute into that area, you need to have ventilation capabilities that will at least let that amount out somewhere else, preferably from the area where the origin of the fire was, so you can push everything back out there. That's where the heat source is being generated. So it's vital to read the smoke and figure out your best strategy for getting that smoke, letting those superheated gases out of that structure as quickly as you possible, which will keep your fire attack crews safer in the end once you do make entry.
All right. Rick, coming to you, you're that group that's making those entries a lot of times and making the hallways and through these structures. When you're in there, what effects do you feel when the wrong stuff is going on, or when maybe it's not as timely as what it should be? You know, maybe it's we've got to train and or have the ability to recognize slowing down some, or how well we coordinate and communicate. And let's talk a little bit about your thoughts in maybe the wrong things happening.
Well, I go back years and years ago when we never wore hoods, and our ears were our indicators. And, you know, I remember when the hoods would come into the fire service, and the older guy said, "Nah, I don't want to cover up my ears." And I was always an advocate for it. Now, getting off the subject a little bit, you had single, double, and triple layer hoods. After being caught in a flashover once in my career, I'm definitely an advocate of hoods. Give me three-layer hoods now. But it took 28 years for me to be in that environment. And hope no one else, or I never go through it again. But like Jeff talked about, our construction's changed. What's burning's changed. It's so much compacter now. We're going in deeper. Our turnout gear is so much better. And we're able to go in deeper. And if you don't educate people on how to read smoke, it's like, you know, when we roll up on a fire ground, the fire is the offense and we're the defense. And if we can't mount a big enough defense to overcome that big offense right there, and that offense is pretty much we're reading that smoke and how dense and how thick and how it's coming out right there, those are vital and crucial in how much water you put in there to eliminate the BTUs. So, you know, we need to use every toolbox, every piece of tool we have in the toolbox when we're making that hallway and reading what's in our environment's doing to us.
All right, Jeff, let's look at this. You know, bottom line is our guys on the inside, you know, that are working hard to suppress fire, our rescue company guys. I can remember riding a rescue when I was in Florida and searching in front of the lines on a lot of these buildings, you know, to affect, you know, civilian rescues, which is our primary focus. How important is it to you guys when y'all are reading the smoke and looking at the tactics that are being deployed inside the building that you make some decisions on ventilation? You know, how does that affect your thought processes, you know, the officer saying this is how we're going to do business?
Well, Doug, I think we all covered this somewhat already, to the point where you kind of got to get a good step back, get a good read on the whole situation. It's going to go back to a favorite buzzword of yours, situational awareness. Again, situational awareness is going to come from our risk-benefit analysis upon arrival on the scene. It's going to become basically the foundation for everything that we're going to do from that point forward. Reading the smoke, we have to look at all the four attributes that are traditionally taught, and we have to take those all in the context of the relative size of the container that we're dealing with at the time, and that's really going to make a determination on which route we're going to take with that. You know, for example, if we have that high turbulent black smoke, high density, high volume, again, a lot of pressure behind it, indicating that we have a lot of heat inside that structure, we're going to have to think about getting that structure actually opened up and let some of that lift so that the engine company can effectively get in there and not have to worry about getting caught up in a flashover type situation. So that's going to definitely play out on how we're going to deploy our personnel once we get there. And again, are we going to be an offensive or defensive mode of operation?
Well, you know, we're talking about some of the key components when we think about offensive attacks, when we're being really aggressive because there's a lot to gain, and we can risk a little, you know, at this point in time to gain that. But there's a lot of other things we got to get going on here. You know, you're pulling up, and, you know, there's water supplies, Rick, and your engineers trying to get everything set on the truck, and y'all are focused not only on fire attack, but the initial primary searches as you're going. The truck company's coming in, and ventilation is not the only job. You know, we got to think about utilities. We got to think about laddering for life. You know, that's it's critical that we have these secondary means of egress from the second to third to fourth floor. Probably one of the things that I see that we don't do is deploy all the components that we should on a fire scene. A lot of times our manpower is indicative that we can't. So we have to start making some thought process of which is more important. And that's difficult for us, especially in any department, any focus or size. And the rule setting that, you know, I'm involved in, it's even more critical. And a lot of what we're seeing is that we don't have enough manpower across the board, period. So, Chief, I'm going to throw it to you here and say, how do we make sure we're accomplishing all these goals with the amount of manpower that we got?
Well, I think each situation is different. You know, I think some decisions have to be made at the time that you arrive. If I only have two people, that changes what I do. If I have three, there again, it changes how you react. If you get three companies that arrive simultaneously, two engines and a truck, that drastically changes what I'm capable of doing at that time. And taking into all the, as Captain Manus referred to, time and distance, how far out are my next two companies that are coming in? It may be that we may have to pop a window and do some horizontal ventilation as we make our attack quickly so we can go on in and take care of some business on our own. But, you know, there again, as Jeff pointed out, depends on the smoke conditions as well. If you have that superheated, dense, black, pressurized smoke coming out, you know you've got an extreme challenge there that's going to take some major ventilation efforts to take place. So it's important to coordinate all those. But, you know, there again, it's how many people do you have there, the resources. That's going to dictate what strategies and tactics. You can't take two people and think you can do like you do when you have 12 on the scene. You have to alter to the situations that you encounter. And that's where the first arriving company officer, battalion chiefs, have critical decisions to make, knowing the time requirements of when they put players in, can add players to the game, what resources you have on the scene. So no one scenario can cover everything. Can't do everything the same way every time, but when I have one crew on the scene, here's what I can do. That's consistent. When I have two engines and a ladder, here's what I can do on the scene. But that comes through years of experience and being able to take you know, all the sessions that you the training that you've had, put it into play.
Well, you bring up a huge point that we're definitely going to talk about in the second part of the show is training and experience. Something that the fire service is beginning to see is a transition of experience out of the business just through attrition of retirement and those type of things. And training today has changed a little bit with our opportunities and our ability to do training based upon scheduling and people's work schedules and how hard it is to get everything accomplished for training, especially in our environments today. The volunteer setting and the career setting both have some unique challenges. So we're at the halfway point. We're going to take a break. Stay tuned. Coming back with Training and Tactics Talk, we're going to talk training. And we're going to try to look at a hardcore piece here to see exactly what information we can give you, our listeners, for better ways to train for these type of operations we're discussing with simultaneous pieces between trucks and rescues and engine companies. So stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Training and Tactics Talk on radiofirehouse.com. And if you have questions, please email in to us. And we would love to hear what you have to say and talk a little bit about Training and Tactics Talk. We did have a question, I think, last time coming in talking about the importance of rapid intervention and some of the new standards that are coming out, and we're going to talk about training. And this came from a gentleman out of West Virginia asking, you know, do I go ahead and train my folks now on this type of information or wait for the standard? And the way that I'll come back and answer that for him is that most of the stuff that's out there currently is going to mirror the standard, the rapid intervention books. I know, Jeff, a lot of what you've written in the RICO book and have been teaching for many years now, along with the same stuff that I've done, pretty much mirror what a lot of folks across the United States are doing. And I think that we go ahead and train our folks. And if there's something new that does come out of this standard, which in looking at it, I don't see anything drastically new that's came out. We just address it at that point and make an upgrade. It's that continuing education component that comes out. But we do encourage our listeners to send their questions to the podcast at radio@firehouse.com. Again, welcome back. With me is Barry Tilley, Deputy Chief of Administration from High Point, Captain Rick Manus, a captain over in Engine Company Number 3 in the city of High Point, Battalion Chief Jeff Pendelski from Downers Grove, Illinois, and I'm your host, Douglas Klein. I'm a training commander at High Point. It's nice to have the guys that I work with on the show. It's something that they bring a lot of expertise to the table. And of course, having my good friend Jeff back on talking about this, and thank Pete Matthews and the folks from Firehouse to allow us to give you this training and tactics that's so critical in today's fire service. And I'm the training guy here. I'm the one that believes that we've got to make a difference through training. And how do we get this training accomplished is very difficult in today's society. And how do we coordinate all these components together? I think that the first of all, I'm going to start out saying that engine company and truck company folks, the officers of those groups, need to be focusing on all the skills of their people. The skills that their people have got to be down to perfection. They've got to be able to perform at the highest level of standards, being able to deploy lines, do water supplies, master streams, search and rescue, those type of things that are important. With our truck company folks, we've got to be able to understand, building construction as it's going to relate to the need for ventilation and our tactics on ventilation. The ability to do search and rescue, working off of ladders, the use of ladders, some techniques like vent inner search. Both of y'all from engine company, truck company works utilizing thermal imaging cameras. But we also have to be able to combine this stuff together. So here's a philosophy that I believe that is paramount to the fire service today, is that our officers, our folks that are in, the companies, and even from a volunteer perspective, we have companies. Officers are generally assigned to groups of people to manage. So we've got to train these people at a company level. And then the bigger picture, what we would do, Chief, is start bringing folks together and incorporating all these skills to scenario-driven exercises that are objective-based, where we've got job performance requirements that we're looking for, all these skills that y'all are teaching that integrate into an operational procedure that is realistic to what we're going to do every day. And I know that a lot of times we train and we got all these people that show up for training, especially in a volunteer setting, and then during the day we got two or three that are really going to be there. Part of what I've seen and what I believe is that philosophy in training realistically. And training for what's going to be occurring. So let's get your thoughts. Chief, I'm going to start with you. How important is that company officer to you making that training happen on a department level where each engine company officer is doing that type of training and each truck officer is doing that and each rescue officer is, training their folks? How important is that to you?
Well, it's extremely important. The company officer, we talk about the leadership of the fire department, fire service, and each individual department. But that company officer is with those personnel 24 hours a day. That's where that training can take place. Now, with that, you need some standardization across your department so that, Captain A can train his personnel consistent as Captain B, C, and D. It needs across the board. Now, that type of consistency. But basically, we need to, and everybody knows this, train like you play and play like you train. And we have to make sure that when we put the training that we've had into practice, we need to use it on the small stuff so that when the big stuff occurs, it's second nature to us. So many times we see that, it's just a room and contents. We don't need to deploy this, this, and this. Well, if you go ahead and practice on the small stuff, go ahead and make sure you have your RIT teams in, your safety officers, your accountability officers. When the big event hits, it comes second nature. It's not something that you have to go back in your memory and go, see, we trained a couple months ago on this, you know. But if you practice it every day, that's hands-on skills, you'll be much better equipped to do it when the time comes to use it and fully implement it.
All right, guys, as officers that have been in these positions and work, just as I have as a company officer, Rick, to you, I mean, I know you spend a lot of time. You've called me a couple of times on the phone, and you've been doing some stuff, asking, you know, a couple of questions. You know, how much time do you think it takes to train folks at that company level, and what do you focus on? How do you get what I would call the level of excellence or the good to great component as a company?
As a company officer, he's like a coach. Every crew is, chemistry is different throughout his whole company. So you may have a new guy, you got to bring him up to where he's going to be a vital link in that chain that you don't necessarily always have to watch over him. So, you know, knowing your chemistry of your company is very vital. And that's where you as a company officer has got to evaluate, like I said, the chemistry of your team. And that's where, you know, you got to keep building his skills, because that team is only going to be as good as its weakest link. And once you establish that, because I've had crews over the years that, and we've been pretty solid from top to bottom. Then I've had some that were not as strong from top to bottom. But, you know, you've got to bring the bottom up to where it's, you know, it's a good happy medium right there. Every company officer would always love to have be strong all the way across. But you know, that's what makes a good company officer, where he can continue training those guys or ladies and make his team stronger all the time. So, you know, once you come to that point that you've got your team strong, I think then you begin to work as a big scenarios and putting that big puzzle together.
Jeff, what you got to add to this?
Well, Doug, actually looking at this, what we've already talked about is company officer is the one that intimately knows those people that are working with them, knows their strengths and weaknesses, and he knows what areas need to be hit upon. But I want to go back to something that you mentioned before you started posing these questions even, and that was about the importance of experience. And we talked about it earlier in the tactics portion of this about experience and how the number of fires that we are actually dropping lines and working at is diminishing over the years. That's leaving us several large gaps in areas that we have to be concerned about now. And I know you were talking a little bit about realistic scenario-based training, and I feel that that's very important that we look at that realistic scenario-based training just from the utilization of the concept of recognition prime decision-making, because we're not getting that experience on the street. We're having a difficult time developing experience levels in our people that are serving as company officers and firefighters, because they're not getting the experience they need to develop a slide in our mind to operate like a slide tray. Basically, what I'm getting at here is when we experience something, we file it away in our mind, and it almost is like putting a slide in a slide tray. And when we get another experience that is similar to that in nature, we're going to be trying to flip through that slide tray to find the slide that closely resembles that instance that we are experiencing at that time to find the solution. And if we don't have that slide in our slide tray, we're gonna be shooting from the hip, and it might not give us the proper solution that we need to keep ourselves as well as the people with us safe. So utilizing that realistic scenario-based training is going to help us overcome that challenge of not having the experience on the street readily available to us as firefighters and fire officers. Through that training, we'll be able to get those slides that we need so that when we do have that one situation, that we have something that we can go back on. Now, the military has utilized recognition prime decision making for a number of years in training troops for combat, and they've been very successful with it. And I think we have to concentrate more in that area as a fire service to overcome that big challenge that we have now of losing all the experienced members, because let's face it, the members of our service that have the experience during the time frame of when we were fighting a lot of fire, they're at the end of their careers now, they're leaving. And sometimes I feel that we're not doing a good enough job in tapping into them and utilizing them as the mentors that we should before they do leave.
Well, you know, that's important. And you talked about experience, and a lot of times you can't give them the field experience that they need from OJT. You know, dropping the lines, being on the fires. We've definitely seen a decrease in fires over the years. So we got to create that. And from a training world, the way that I see that occurring and a lot of what's going on and being tied with the International Society of Fire Service Instructors, we're seeing this through a lot of different pieces. We're seeing the need for more hands-on training. We're seeing the need for live fire training and scenarios that are driven that way. We're seeing the need for simulation to begin to add these components that are missing. All this, what I call inputted data that they need, the quantitative analysis components of information that's there in their RMS system, their resource and, you know, information management systems for that slide tray doesn't exist. You called it the gap in the slide or the missing slide. So I think what we've got to do is we've got to exhaust all of our resources to put an end to the missing slide. So part of what we're going to have to do is go to simulations. You know, simulate some of the events that are there in your community and begin giving them that information or the prelude to the reality. You know, you can't be out every day burning. It's just technically impossible. With the environmental controls and things, it's very difficult to do, you know, structural burns. But I think that that's critical. And I think what we have to do is begin from a training perspective, from our level as part of a training division, is incorporate this type of pieces into our training with scenario driven from maybe the simulation to our hands-on experience that we go to particular buildings. And we tap those resources that exist. And, you know, maybe we don't put necessarily fire in there, but we put some conditions that fit. I know that later today, as, you know, we're putting this podcast together, I'm going to be traveling to Vermont. And in Vermont, I'm doing searching in the modern environment. And we know our modern environment is drastically different. So what we're creating for the environment is because of, you know, the stringence of 1403 is we're going to a very heavy, you know, smoked environment with smoke machines. But to create the heat that does go with that, which is critical. I mean, training in 52-degree weather houses is different than being in a 125-degree environment, is we've got Karasan Torpedo heaters that are going to be strategically, you know, placed around this house that are blowing into the house to raise the environment and the temperature so that when they're in there, they're having to deal with 125-degree temperatures. We're creating that. We've added furniture. A lot of times you go to these places and you train and they're empty buildings. Well, that's not realistic. It's not like crawling down a hallway in a hotel and having to search these rooms that have furniture in them. You know, if that's the scenario, we've got to create that. We've got to get out there and go that extra effort. And this is one of the things that I think is critical in our training components of tactics, is that we oftentimes don't put forth the effort, or we don't see people putting forth the effort as an officer, as a training division, to truly go that extra mile and give realistic training. And I think you had something you wanted to throw in there, Jeff.
Doug, listening to you respond to what I had to say actually sparked another thought up in the back of my mind. We talk about this experience. And another thing, too, is since we're not dropping line and getting this experience on a daily basis like we did in the past, another thing we have to look at is sharing from others' experiences. And what I'm referring to that is vicarious learning, learning through others' mistakes, utilizing case studies in the proper manner. A lot of times I don't feel that our training divisions are utilizing case studies in the proper way that they should be. You know, for the most part, a lot of times the case study gets dropped down in a firehouse and we look at it for a week and, you know, maybe we armchair quarterback it and, you know, basically tear it apart on what the guys or gals did wrong in it. Instead, I think we have to start taking a look at those in a better manner by possibly saying, okay, this happened to this particular fire department, but how can I be in that same situation? How does this apply to me? How can I get caught into these same traps? You know, we all know, the guys that have been in the fire service for a while, that if you work the job long enough, you're going to make mistakes in the job. You know, we have to be more open about sharing those mistakes with one another so that they don't get repeated. And that's another way of building that slide tray up that we do have.
You bring something that's really unique there, and I want to kick this up one more level. Okay, and I'm going to converse with Chief Tilly here on this. How do we share that information across the board? You said share it across the board. Part of what we're looking and experimenting at in the fire service today is utilizing technology. I know you've got a pretty profound knowledge of some of the stuff that's out there because that's part of what you've been looking into, Chief, for research and development, how we can do this. Let's talk about delivering all these case studies and the sharing of information. Say Jeff has, you know, a pretty unique situation he wants to share. How can he share it with Captain Manus over here, who's, you know, on a completely different shift? How do we do that and still stay within our economic confines that we're up against in today's society?
Well, I think in today's world, to say that anyone in the fire service doesn't have some level of access to the internet would be an understatement. Practically anywhere you go today, you have access there to emails, to websites like firehouse.com. All of our stations do, and I would bet that most of our employees would have that at their home even. But the mindset and the culture is where we really have to start driving this home. You can feed me all the information and case studies that you would like, but if I don't take those to heart and do as Jeff said, bring those back, do we have an operational practice? Do we enter into environments to where that same situation can occur to us? We not only have to see that, but then if we identify that that could happen in our department, we need to look all the way down through our training methods, what we train on, how we train. We need to look at our operational procedures, make sure that we adjust those so that that doesn't happen in our department. But a lot of times I think, you know, it's not going to happen to me. That's not going to happen in my department because we're a great department. And we all, pride is that one thing that gets in our way. It'll never happen here. But it's when you least expect it that that's when things creep up on you. But with the technology today, internet, email, you can get it out there. There's no problem with that. Unfortunately, line of duty deaths and the NIOSH reports that come out from that, that is how we get a lot of our information, the real detailed studies. And unfortunately, as Jeff also alluded to, you know, sometimes we're a little reluctant to share our experiences that didn't go so well when mistakes occurred. And, you know, getting that to change is extremely tough. But I think the real challenge is when something happens, a case study does come out, that we look at those, take them seriously, and if we identify issues in there that are common to my department as well, we need to drill down and make sure we eliminate those weaknesses.
I think that we bring something, you know, heavily to light here is John Tibbett and those guys at Near Miss is probably one of the most underused pieces for training for this vicarious learning that you bring up. The amount of information that's put on there is substantially low as compared to what I know is really going on. And you alluded to this, Chief, is that we're not getting people sharing information. Maybe we're not willing, maybe we're a little embarrassed. But I think we've got the ability to do a couple of things. And one of them is exactly what we're doing here, podcasting. We can create our own podcasts very easy. All you have to do is go to audacity.com, download that, have a $20 headset from Walmart, go in there, and we can sit there and actually record, or just a regular microphone, and record all this stuff. And it could be shared amongst every single station and done in a teaching manner. And the training division could coordinate this. They could do a lot of this stuff. And even interviews or post-incident critiques or analysis. There's web meetings that we can do, DimDim. And, you know, the Open Fire Academy is another one that is working very hard to share information across the fire service. So there's opportunities there for departments to tie into that. I think part of our culture in training is that we're not willing to experience new stuff necessarily. And I think that's where we have to do. We're hung up on this is how we've always done it, or this is, you know, I'll say the rough and fire department way. Well, it could be the way, but is there a better way? And I have a philosophy that if it's not broke, we need to break it. We need to find a better way. And we need to be pushing forward and utilizing all the abilities. And technology is just one. And I find that is to be such a resistance in our training folks. And even, you know, down to the company officer level, so that there's not a comfort zone there maybe for them to use it. But this is a way that we can train folks a lot different and begin doing. I know that some of the classes I'm doing now are in a virtual classroom. We can create that virtual classroom, and it can be recorded. And companies can be right there. They can watch it. They can see videos. They can see slides. They can see documents. It can be shared. It can be put into formats. Blackboard is another example if you've got that. There's a lot of resources that are out there for training that I don't think we're tapping into that can show the importance of what we're, you know, back to on training and tactics. The tactics component, we train them that, you know, how important was it that we learned something that maybe we did the wrong ventilation for the engine company, or the deployment of the hose line. Maybe we chose the wrong hose line, and this is how. Or we found a way to do something, just like, you know, teaching in Henderson, North Carolina, for that department. And the captain that was on there said, you know, I'm not probably capable of doing some of this, but what if we tried, you know, something new here? And the use of a ladder to put somebody on and use it as a fulcrum to be able to lift them and push them out the window in rapid intervention. And that became part of what we actually train with today, from somebody that had an innovative thought or another way. So I truly believe that if it's not broke, we do need to break it, and we need to find another way. So I'm going to pick on some folks here across the room and just really see your thoughts to this. What type of job are we doing training today's fire service across the board? And I'm going to throw it to you, Rick, first. What type of job are we doing? We doing a good job? We doing a bad job? And if so, which one? Why?
I think we're doing a job, but like you said, we can always improve.
Okay. Room for improvement. What about you, Chief?
Well, I definitely think there's always room for improvement. To say that there's not, acquired structures, live burns, you know, hands-on, those are great ways to train our personnel. But you can't do those every day. So taking advantage of this technology, and some of it's not so high-tech. It's things, simple things you can do around the station to reinforce your incident command procedures, to implement your SOGs in daily training. So as you do it throughout the department in a common way. It is very important. But there's always room to improve. Never get to the point to say good enough is good enough. Always say that there's room for improvement.
Jeff, your thoughts here.
Well, Doug, I have to agree with both Rick and Chief here and everything that they said, especially with what Chief referred to as the live hands-on training, how important it is to our firefighters and how difficult it is to actually give that realistic type training nowadays because of the parameters that are in place environmentally. The avenues that are out there that are available, though, they are endless. And as a fire service, I strongly feel that we're only limited by our imagination when it comes to training. Again, there is always, like the other two guys already said, room for improvement, and we just have to try to keep being innovative and trying to come up with ideas that are out of the box as far as training goes. Again, it doesn't have to take a lot of money to be good training. You know, some of the best training that you can do is training that costs only a couple dollars to maybe no dollars in your own fire station. But instructors, company officers, they just have to use some innovation and use their imagination a little bit. But I do feel that there are a lot of avenues out there, and we're just not tapping into all of them properly.
Well, to kind of go and put a cap on this as we're winding down to the end of the podcast here, back to the tactics component, I think it's imperative that we're doing all the tactics that are necessary to mitigate an incident. We know that fire propagation is definitely different today than what it was 20 years ago. It's inherently affected by the designs and the aesthetics of buildings, the anatomy of how they're truly built, and how the fire wants to behave in that type of environment. The types of fire phenomenon, that rapid fire phenomenon and progression, is based upon the materials in those features itself. We know that we're putting much more fuel load into a building. We're creating this blinding smoke because of the types of materials that it's built out of. They're basically hydrogen-carbon chains. In other words, we're throwing diesel fuel, if you will, you know, into a couch, into the foam rubber. So I think it's imperative that we're really focusing on the simultaneous deployment of tactics that are integrated between engines and trucks and or ladders and rescue companies and command level. And I think we got to put a lot of this stuff together. It's simultaneous. As far as the training of those, I think that we really have to get back to an attitude of there's no excuses. We've got to move from good to great. And a lot of people say, well, we're a good department. We're a good department. Well, to me, talk is cheap. Let's prove it. Let's don't be a good department. Let's foster that mentality in the training of our crews and the company level, in our volunteer departments, you know, with the groups or divisions, however we set those up. Well, oftentimes we don't have a lot of time in those environments to be able to spend and work. I mean, these folks are trying to make a living. They're working sometimes two jobs. The training demands on volunteer fire service has drastically increased. We need to provide quality into that. You know, if we got quality, you know, we're going to have the quantity that's got to be there. This has got to be the quality that's there. I think we need to take advantage of some technology. The webinars that are on firehouse.com, the podcast, can be used by every fire department across the United States. Pretty much podcasts are free, and they're up on firehouse.com, and a lot of this is out there. We can go to the Near Miss. It's free. NOS reports are free. Actually, just having a little bit of energy. And to kind of lead the final fleeting thought here, it's about attitude. And the attitude of how we deploy your tactics, the thought processes that go into how we do it is about attitude. Are we going to have a safe attitude, or are we going to be reckless? You know, are we going to be aggressive or reckless? You know, how are we thinking here? But we definitely know that the integration of tactics among companies and individual crews that are working is critical. And the training is the tie that binds all that together. I want to thank you all for being on Training and Tactics Podcast. It's definitely an honor and a privilege to sit with such great folks in the fire service that are doing a lot. I know that Rick has mentored many folks in the High Point Fire Department. I know that Chief Tilley is making a big impact there with some of the technology, and some folks are having to kick and scream along through there. But he's got an upcoming program that's going to be introducing some accountability pieces, some new technology that's out there for real-time accountability tracking at the Southeast Association of Fire Chiefs Conference in Myrtle Beach, coming up June 18th through the 20th. You can check that out on the Southeast Association of Fire Chiefs website and register for that conference if you're interested. A lot of good training coming up. Not too far off is Firehouse Expo. We've got some folks that are probably going to be there. I think you're going to be there, Jeff. You're not there. I know that we're probably going to be attending and having an opportunity to train from the student perspective, which will be great. We need that as officers as well, and officers are students of the fire service. So, again, we appreciate y'all tuning in to Training and Tactics Talk. As always, our focus is giving the right information to the people on the streets to where we're making a difference in everybody going home and people staying safe. If you do have questions, we ask you to send those in to radio@firehouse.com so that we can get those answered for you. And if you have comments, please put those up on the website. Again, stay tuned. We look forward to having you next month on Training and Tactics Talk. I'm Douglas Klein, your host. We appreciate you joining in, and stop by again and check out everything Firehouse has to offer. Guys, thank you all again for being on, and we'll look forward to our listeners being back with us next month.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.